This is the session on dead zones, hypoxia, and nutrient loading. Is pollution trading the answer? If that's not the session you intended to be in, check out in the hallway. There are lots of others out there, but thank you for stopping by. My name is Tim Wheeler. I'm a reporter with the Baltimore Sun. And this session is about a topic that's near and dear to my heart, hypoxia or dead zones. If you've been here for a little while, you've heard an awful lot about Hurricane Katrina and the oil spills and all the other insults to the Louisiana coast. This is one that's been going on for much longer, a more chronic one, but also a very serious one. So we've assembled this panel to sort of review where we are and where it's going. First question, I guess, might be, does anybody not know what a dead zone is? What hypoxia is? Okay, good. I mean, I guess that's good. It's a test. Well, I will say that on the first day I was here, I met somebody and I told them what my panel was, and they did say, "What's a dead zone?" So I thought, we better have that reality check before we start. And I'm sorry that person isn't here. So anyway, this is a map you've probably seen if you're familiar with this issue already. This is the Gulf of Mexico dead zone. This is the most recent map, I guess, right of the size. It's actually a little smaller than average this year, about the size of Connecticut, 5,000 square miles. And this is I will let our speakers here in a moment go over this, but this is an indication of how it's fluctuated. This is a dead zone in the Chesapeake Bay. It's a little bit harder to picture because it's a vertical shot, but that red and orange stuff in the middle there is the area of the bay that has low or no oxygen in it, depending on the degree of redness in it. And this is the end of my slideshow. This is what the impact of that is. Those are dead crabs in the Chesapeake Bay from a hypoxic episode there. So we have a really great panel today. Very distinguished, and hopefully they're going to cover this topic to your satisfaction, or at least give you some things to think about. Our speakers today, from my left all the way across, Nancy Rabelais, professor and executive director of the Louisiana University Marine Consortium. Why don't we start with you, Nancy, and tell us a little bit about the situation with the Gulf and about dead zones in general. How many of them are there? And how is the what's being done about them from your perspective? How is the progress being?
Okay. Well, thanks, Tim. Thank you for having me here. This is my stomping ground, so I welcome anybody who's not from Louisiana here. Actually, my stomping ground is Baton Rouge and Cocodrie, Louisiana, which is where my marine lab is. As Tim mentioned, this year's low oxygen area was a little bit less than average. I think my calculations were 6,500 square miles, which is less than the long-term average, 7,500, but it's three times larger than the goal that the task force is aiming for, which is 1,900 square miles. I have to think in square miles when I'm talking to non-scientists. Well, not that you're non-scientists. So it's very closely related to the nitrogen and phosphorus. It's very closely related to the nitrogen and phosphorus that comes from the river, along with the amount of fresh water. But if you had to pick a single factor that was the most related to the distribution of, and the size, it would be the nitrate load in spring. And it's been consistently explaining about 80% of the variability in the river over time. These nutrients come primarily from agricultural sources. It's an agricultural landscape or a range landscape. There are cities that do contribute, but less than about 10% of the nitrogen and phosphorus comes from municipalities. The U.S. Geological Survey has done a very good job with their sparrow modeling and their evaluations to say where they know where it comes from. I'm going to digress a little bit from what I was told to do. I don't know a thing about nutrient trading, but I do know what will and will not solve the problem. So I'm just going to go through these. We're in Louisiana. You've heard a lot about coastal diversions of Mississippi River to build wetlands. Coastal diversions will not solve the hypoxia problem, contrary to what you might hear from CPRA, the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority. There's not enough acreage of the uptake rate necessary to reduce enough nutrients to make a difference, maybe 5%. The high nutrients also lead to harmful algal blooms in the waters in which they're being delivered, and the high nutrients also affect the health of marshes and even their loss. So the solution to pollution is not redistribution. Make that point. The other thing that will not solve the problem is changing the goal, which will be happening shortly, either making some smaller steps or changing the reduction loads. But it's been 14 years now, and there has been no major change in the loads. The economic incentives that might work would be incentives for conservation or disincentives by working on subsidies from the Farm Bill. Another one that would work would be regulation. And there are economic models that show how you can change farm practices, save money, and also reduce the distribution of the hypoxia. So I'm stop with that because I've said a lot. Thank you.
That way. So that, no, we're going to do a Q&A here first. Nancy, let me ask you a couple questions. Hold my mic down and you hold yours up. So this graph that we've got up here right now, this is sort of the measurements of the hypoxic zone over time, right, since the 80s. And it looks like there might be a little progress there. Is that illusory?
The size is so related to the amount of nitrate that you have to take into account precipitation and other things over the years. I think the five-year average, running average, has come down a bit over the last several years. Some of those changes are due to hurricanes or other events that make the size of the low oxygen area smaller than predicted. So I would say no, I would say that the distance between the five-year average and the action plan goal is still significant, and it's going to take a lot of work.
So, and you're pretty confident at this point that the scientists know where this stuff is coming from?
I am. That's been very clearly shown by different types of modeling for the nitrogen and phosphorus loads, and also the U.S. Geological Survey is really on top of this.
So what's the problem? Why isn't that number coming down faster?
There are a lot of small farmers, small acreage farmers, and concerned farmers that are making great progress in changing activities on their land. But the majority of the nutrients come from big agribusiness, and it's an economic issue, and driven by global, you know, trade that requires them to hedge their bets with a lot of fertilizer. But you can make changes in best management practices earlier in the year, not as much precision fertilizer, working with the tile drains to try to work on the quality of that water before it gets to the nearest stream. So the closer to the source is where you need to make the most important changes.
Okay. Yeah, 1 second.
Okay, sure.
All right, and we'll get to it. Just one last question here, Nancy, on the impacts. I mean, this area out here, large area, but the Gulf is a huge area. Is there measurable impact on fish, crabs?
Well, when the auction's below two, which is the area within that black line, a trawler cannot catch anything on the bottom, which means the important commercial fishery of brown shrimp and white shrimp, or recreational fishers going after red drum or red snapper. So it does diminish the catch. The economics is more difficult because so many other things can affect the economy, such as the price of diesel, the amount of foreign imports. Will they just give up and stay home if they can't afford to go out and get them? It blocks the migration of smaller shrimp to the deeper waters where they can grow to a larger size. So some of it's a loss in production that can't be calculated.
Okay. Our next speaker, thank you, Nancy, is Ellen Galinsky, Senior Policy Advisor for the Office of Water of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Ellen, thank you for being here.
Yes.
I guess the question for you is, so what's being done about this?
Okay.
All right.
Sure. And I'll be happy to address that. And thanks for the excellent lead-in, Nancy. So nutrient pollution is one of the biggest challenges that we face, and certainly a key focus area for the Office of Water at EPA. And it's while the pollution in the Mississippi River Basin is one of our focuses, we are focusing on this all over the country. It's not just happening here. It's happening everywhere. So we have a nutrient strategy, and the goals of that strategy, a nutrient reduction strategy, are to reduce sources of nitrogen and phosphorus pollution to protect human health as well as aquatic resources, because this high levels of nutrients can also be a health issue, too many nitrates in drinking water, things like that. So it's really affects the whole ecosystem. We want to restore areas that are already degraded, such as the Gulf of Mexico drainage area, and decrease the hypoxic zone, of course. We are working to build federal, state, and local capacity to plan for and reduce such pollution through regulatory and voluntary means. As Nancy alluded to, the main source of nutrient pollution in the Mississippi River Basin is agriculture. That's been shown by the scientists and modeling and everything else. And that's unregulated. The Clean Water Act does not have regulations for non-point source pollution. We have voluntary programs. That's in contrast, let's say, in the Chesapeake Bay, which is another area that you mentioned, Tim, that has a hypoxic zone. While non-point sources are important, actually the larger percentage comes from point sources, such as sewage treatment plants and industries, and regulated stormwater areas, municipal stormwater. And those areas do, those sources are regulated. There's permits. The permits have limits in them. They have to treat them. So really the combination of where the sources come from really dictates where you need to look at. So in the Mississippi River Basin, we're working in partnership with the USDA and other federal agencies to look at what kind of voluntary incentives we can use with the states, with the producers, to drive source reduction. And one of those ways is nutrient trading, which Michelle's going to talk about later.
Okay. Let me back you up for just a second here, and I want to be sure I understand this. You sort of contrast the situation in the Gulf and the sources of the pollution with the Bay and said that point sources and stormwater were a bigger share. They are, but the majority of the pollution is still coming from ag runoff, is it not, in the Bay?
In the Chesapeake Bay?
Right.
Well, the
And you all aren't exactly powerless to deal with
yes.
it there, are you?
No.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for teeing that up. So in the Bay, because the reductions have already taken place in a lot of the sewage treatment plants, because they all have nutrient limits in their permits, nitrogen phosphorus limits. So there already has been reduction. The remaining reductions in the Chesapeake Bay are from the non-point source community. And when Tim says that we do have, are able to do that, get those reductions because the Chesapeake Bay has a TMDL, total maximum daily load, which is really a cleanup plan or pollution diet, as we like to call it in the vernacular. But so as part of that plan, each state had to develop a watershed implementation plan to address their non-point sources as well as point sources. So they have certain reductions that are required from agriculture, from industry, from stormwater, and they have plans to achieve that. But again, the ways to achieve it from agriculture are still really voluntary for the most part. There's not permits.
Okay. Michelle, why don't we jump in with you here then at this point. Michelle Perez with Senior Associate Water Quality with World Resources Institute. I'll get out of here so you can hit the slides here. Real quick here. Let's see how we get out of this.
I'll do it.
Tee it up. Okay. And while you're doing that, I guess the question that sort of to set the stage for this, you know, this idea of pollution trading comes about because, and I haven't, you know, done my job here, the cost of dealing with this is astronomical, as you might imagine. We're talking about basically the stuff that comes from everything we do in life. You know, plants, we plant things, we plant gardens, we plant crops, all that sewage, all these things are calculated in the billions of dollars to clean up, to reduce. And, you know, in case you hadn't noticed, nobody's raising taxes anymore. And so they're looking for ways to finance this. And so, Michelle, the concept here is that somehow you get people to use the market as opposed to government telling you to reduce. And there's a profit incentive in here for people. Is that right?
That's the idea.
Okay. You want to tell us a little bit about how this works?
Thank you. So thanks, everybody, for having me here. So this was a great tee up. The reason why we're talking about nutrient trading is because the voluntary approach is limited. The regulatory approach is limited, right? We have the Clean Water Act that doesn't provide the authority to EPA to regulate farmers. By and large, the vast majority of the nitrogen and phosphorus and sediment pollution causing dead zones in the country and here in the Gulf come from agriculture. So instead, we turn to the voluntary program approach. Well, what's wrong with that? There is not too much wrong with that. It does solve individual water quality problems on individual farms, right? To the tune of about $5 billion of your taxpayer dollars a year goes into these voluntary programs. The shortcomings are that only about 7% of that of those funds are actually for these nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment control practices. So it's the rest of the money is going to wildlife, the rest of the money is going to water quantity, air quality, other great important issues. But heretofore, the pot for this pollution problem is pretty small. The reach then is only about, we found 8.7 million acres of the 300 million acres here in the country on average every year get to have the cost share from these programs. So the voluntary program approach is what we have to turn to, but it's very limited, as we said, but it does work on individual fields. So what we've at World Resources Institute and many other environmental organizations are trying to get NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the USDA agency that implements these programs to do, is try to use these limited funds to actually solve in water quality problems in watersheds. So on the left, you have the unhappy stream in red. You know, very few creatures can live there. That's because these pollution solutions, represented by the stars, are broadly dispersed across the landscape. When you target, you concentrate those financial resources and those technical assistance dollars, and you try to clean up the pollution causing that problem and restore that stream. We have three reports that just came out this year on various ways to target on and identifying the current barriers preventing more targeting from occurring. So I encourage you to visit this website for that. And this is just the optimization analysis in our second report that indicates if you have to spend the $330 million a year that on average we spend on these nutrient sediment erosion control technologies, where would you best spend them? And these happen to be the locations where we could do the greatest bang for our taxpayer buck. These are the most cost-effective locations. I can imagine that you all know what the political difficulties are of trying to concentrate funds from where they currently are. So we can get into that later. So we turn, we say, oh my gosh, the regulatory approach limited, the voluntary approach limited, what else do we have in our policy toolbox? Well, we have market-based mechanisms. And the reason why they are appealing to us, at least theoretically, is that there is this huge cost differential. You see in red and yellow on the left, the stormwater technologies and the septic system technologies are hugely expensive when you compare them over here on the right in green to agricultural farm best management practices. And in the purple is the wastewater treatment plants. And those are the folks that Ellen was talking about. Your Clean Water Act is able to regulate. And we hope we get them interested. Let me just say one more thing. Ellen mentioned that in the Bay, the solutions of applying permits for nitrogen and phosphorus to wastewater treatment plants is working to help clean up that portion of the pollution problem. We were astonished in the study I'm about to tell you about here in the Mississippi River Basin at how few point sources are regulated for nitrogen and phosphorus. They're regulated for ammonia, for total suspended solids, and for other things, but they're not heretofore regulated for nitrogen and phosphorus. So one policy regulatory tool in our toolbox that's not really being implemented by your state water quality agencies is to regulate point sources. Just want to say that.
Basically to crank down on the people you can regulate. I mean, the question that comes out of this is all very good here, Michelle. This is like basically plant trees. It's a lot cheaper to plant a tree than it is to upgrade your wastewater treatment plant, right? Many times less. But what's the incentive for that guy to pay to plant trees, even a fraction of the cost of upgrading his wastewater treatment plant? Why would he do that? Because he's a good guy? Because he cares about the environment? What's that worth to him?
Exactly. And we can't get his or her attention if, we did our study and we kept interviewing these wastewater treatment facilities. They're like, yeah, sounds good, but talk to me when I get that permit, right? I'm not really interested in this now. And when I have to get interested in this, when I receive a permit, I have to go to my board and figure out, can I spend money outside of my jurisdiction, outside of the city, outside of the state? God forbid, World Resources Institute is telling me that we can find pollution reductions from farms outside of my state. How are my ratepayers and my taxpayers going to feel about that? So there's some technical challenges. Two things. As reporters, when anyone talks to you about nutrient trading, I want two questions to always come to your mind. One is, what is the water body of concern that these groups want to help clean up with nutrient trading, and what is the pollution reduction goal? Without those two things, nutrient trading just becomes something interesting and not really helpful. So our study looked at the Gulf of Mexico dead zone and the famous 45% reduction goal from the Science Advisory Board report. And these are our point sources up in the watershed in Illinois and in Kentucky, and our non-point source agricultural fields. And this was an economic modeling analysis. Nobody actually traded anything, right? The major findings were that, of course, these agricultural watersheds have a long way to go in terms of achieving the 45% nitrogen and phosphorus reduction goal on their individual fields. The good news is that we saw the vast majority of them can get there with the simple, common farm practices that we were able to model in partnership with USDA. So it's doable. You can get there. There are 15% of these acres that you can't get there with these technologies, and they'd require, more significant intervention. And the other good news story is that 16% are already there, either due to good management already by farmers, or they just got lucky and they're on flat land, so their hydrologic conditions are not environmentally bad. The significant challenge is, this is a graphic trying to show you, these three Arkansas watersheds compared, how much it would cost them to actually achieve that 45% reduction goal for their watershed is about 4 to 5 times the amount of money that their entire state receives in taxpayer resources, right? So the reach of voluntary programs to help financially the farmers install these practices is way underfunded, right? It's not rising to the level of funding. That's why we turn to trading. And so we find if we could get the attention of these utilities, we found that the two utilities could meet all of their nitrogen needs if they were to receive a permit that required a 45% reduction, just by offering 25% of what it would cost them to install technologies on site to comply with that permit. So this wastewater treatment plant, if they had to do it all on their own, it would take about $4.50 per pound of nitrogen on site. If they offered $1 to the farming community, the farming community would jump on that potentially and supply even more nitrogen than that one wastewater treatment plant would need. The solution, the situation for phosphorus is very different. Because of the amount of phosphorus credits that a watershed can generate. So even if this one utility offered 75% of its on-site costs and therefore didn't have much savings, it would not be able to achieve its phosphorus goals through trading. Of course, this is just six watersheds, so it would have to find others elsewhere to trade with. The bottom line is that nitrogen trading could save these utilities $900 million, or two-thirds of the cost. This red area is what they would not have to ask their taxpayer or their ratepayers to pay. They would have to only pay this green area. And the profits to farmers represents this area. It's a little bit bigger because we just said they would respond to these prices, and we assume that there are other buyers out in the marketplace. So it's a win-win for ratepayers economically and for farmers to send that economic signal to get their attention. Okay. And that's it.
Thank you.
And I have a lot of other slides to go into the technical details later if anybody wanted.
All right. Well, it sounds very appealing and very simple. We're going to ask a little bit later why it isn't happening a little bit more particularly. But I think Pat, our next speaker, can sort of bring us up to speed on some of the legal and political issues around this. Pat Parento, professor of law, senior counsel, Environmental and Natural Resources Law Clinic at Vermont Law School. So, Pat, what's the problem here? Why aren't we making progress on doing these things?
Yeah, we've been at it for quite a while. Some of you may remember that one of the precursors to the 1972 Clean Water Act was the pronouncement that Lake Erie was dead. And you may remember the famous Monty Python skit where, you know, during the medieval Great Death, they were hauling people out of the castle and the guy was saying, "I'm not dead yet." Well, you may have also read lately that Lake Erie once again is declared dead, at least in some of the bays, with the algal mats spreading across the water intake supplies for major cities around Lake Erie. Another episode that triggered the Clean Water Act was the death of 25 million fish in Lake Apopka in Florida prior to the 1972 Act. So there ain't nothing new here, folks. We've been at this a long time. We've been collaborating a long time. For a while, the only thing we did at the federal level was convene meetings to talk about it and try to jawbone people into doing things. Voluntary compliance is wonderful when you get it. We haven't. We haven't gotten it nearly enough anywhere in the country. Even in the great, green, clean state of Vermont, we have two bays right now that have blue-green algae on them, St. Albans Bay and Missisquoi Bay, adjacent to Franklin County, right up on the Canadian border. And our precious, wonderful, beautiful Holstein dairy cows are the source of the shit. And so even in a supposedly progressive green state like Vermont, we ain't getting it done. So the legal landscape is very interesting. Three major cases going on across the country. One right here, of course, with the Gulf Dead Zone. The Gulf Restoration Network case against EPA under Section 303 requiring EPA to set numeric criteria for nutrients in the entire Mississippi River watershed. An undertaking that I'm sure Ellen can't wait to sink her teeth into. And I'm sure she'll receive all kinds of boxes of chocolate and roses from Congress if she does. Judge, is it Vaney, your local federal district judge, sided with the plaintiffs in that case and awarded them a procedural victory and said, "Yeah, EPA, you can't just sit there on the throne. You've got to actually make a decision. Are you going to set a numeric standard or not?" It's called a necessity determination, another one of these technical and procedural requirements built into many different laws. In fact, The judge in this particular case looked to the Massachusetts versus EPA case, the Supreme Court's, you know, seminal case on Clean Air Act authority to regulate greenhouse gases as his precedent for saying that EPA's at least got to make a decision. Judge said, you know, the plaintiffs are not seeking, nor is this court prepared to order EPA to set numeric standards for nutrients in the Mississippi River watershed, but they at least have to make a decision, and they have 180 days to do it. Case was on is on appeal to the Fifth Circuit, where, shall we say, environmentalists don't enjoy a robust record of victory. So it's anybody's guess as to what the Fifth Circuit will do and who shows up for the argument and, you know, what they may decide. My prognostication is, because it's a pretty technical, procedural, modest kind of decision by the lower court, it'll be upheld. And one way or another, EPA will have to make a decision. The judge has made it pretty clear that EPA has a lot of discretion as to what it ultimately does. It doesn't have to just rely on the science, which is, of course, what most people concerned about the nutrient problem are hoping, and what the plaintiffs certainly are hoping. The judge seemed to allow them to take into consideration policy considerations as well as scientific considerations in deciding whether to proceed, to take into things like cooperative federalism, which we've been at for a very long time with nutrients, and consider things like sticking with narrative standards, which are, by any other name, unenforceable standards. So numbers count, numbers matter, numbers produce results, and unless and until we have numbers on nutrients, we're not going to have results.
And, Pat, the numbers you're talking about are basically setting a limit on how much.
Setting a limit, yeah, and you can do that. These are criteria limits. Once you set the criteria, you still have to assess whether water bodies are meeting them or not, and whether they're impaired or not, and whether they go on the list of dirty waters or not. And if they go on the list of dirty waters, do you have to produce this TMDL pollution budget? Yes, you do, if they go on the list. Another case, and I know I can't go on and on here, I'll try to limit it, but a couple of other cases you really have to keep your eye on. Obviously, Chesapeake Bay, I'll return to that in a minute, but in Florida, there's been, you know, a decade-long fight over nutrients regulation in the state of Florida, and then environmental groups petitioned for EPA to set numeric limits, and this went back and forth. Ultimately, there was a settlement in the case in which EPA agreed to set a statewide numeric standard for nutrients, both phosphorus and nitrogen, in Florida. They made a couple of technical mistakes and left an opening for the ag industry and the sugar industry in Florida to challenge EPA's proposed numeric standards. And the judge said, you screwed up in a couple of places. I'm going to remand it to you. Of course, by the time it goes back to EPA, the forces of hell have marshaled themselves around EPA and made it absolutely certain that EPA was not going to come out with another federal top-down numeric standard. In the meantime, Florida had come up with an alternative approach, which does have a numeric standard for nutrients, but it's loaded with loopholes, excludes all kinds of water bodies that have been modified. And if you think about southern Florida for a minute, is there anything that isn't modified? So there's a lot of water now that's come out of the requirement for numeric standards and lots of other ways in which the state of Florida can avoid listing a lot of waters that really should be listed as impaired for nutrients. So that's the story in Florida. If I have 1 minute on Chesapeake.
1 minute.
That's a very interesting case. That's standing federalism on its head. So here you have EPA working with the states in the basin after many years, lots of collaboration. Oh, my God, collaboration. And finally, the state's basically saying, you know, almost like somebody with their position surrounded by the enemy, bomb us, okay, but calling in airstrikes because they can't move the needle on nutrients in the bay without EPA coming out of the closet, the gorilla in the closet coming out and saying, okay, let's have a real TMDL, a real pollution budget with real numbers and real plans and real timetables, and let's get going. And, of course, the Farm Bureau, and it, you know, it reads like a who's who, a big pig, big cow, big beef, big everybody, doesn't like it.
Big chicken.
States as far away as Alaska don't like it for reasons I can't quite figure out. I have the feeling has something to do with ideology, but whatever it is, there's a whole bunch of people very upset with the fact that EPA, with the state's cooperation in the basin, you understand, have come up with a TMDL. That's on appeal. The district court in Pennsylvania upheld it. That's on appeal to the Third Circuit. Keep your eye on that, and I'll shut up.
Okay. Thank you, Pat. All right. That's right. Well, there's a lot of ground covered here real fast, so we're going to have plenty of time for Q&A. I'm going to give Ellen a chance to respond to some of this. I know she's been champing at the bit because she's been scribbling over there like mad. Before we do that, though, I want to turn back to the scientist and ask a couple questions here. As it's clear, Nancy, the Gulf is not the only place where this is happening. Is this basically everywhere? I mean, how many dead zones are there out there?
There were 550 yesterday, and today there are 552.
552?
I don't know. It keeps accelerating, the numbers, but there are documented in coastal waters, human-caused low oxygen, 550 areas around the world, most of them in Europe and North America, but more and more in South America, Asia, developing countries, and the symptoms have sort of shifted on a timeline. Ours began around the 60s primarily, and theirs are beginning around the 80s as they try to catch up with us economically and want to take advantage of their resources and have a better standard of living.
Sounds a little bit like the whole carbon global warming issue.
It's
the stuff of life,
I
guess.
If you're going to be there at 12:15 in another room, a lot of this is tied to human population growth and wanting to use resources.
Okay. And you, in your first remarks on this, said that there were a lot of farmers who have done things up in the watershed to try to help. Are there enough of them doing it? Is what they're doing working?
Well, these are the small bars at the end of Michelle's graph, doing small things that can help their land be more productive and more diversified. Diversified agriculture is definitely better than the corn-soybean rotation that will eventually become non-existent. So people are doing sustainable ag. They're leaving crops over the winter. They're not plowing up. They've got deeper roots, and they're just more sustainable. And then they're also creating wetlands and leasing their land for hunting. And so there's all kinds of things that they can do to diversify. The big row crops are not in that category. So I'll give you one more soundbite on when I was talking about take care of it at the source. Denial is not a large river in North America.
It's not a large what river? It seems like it. So second only to the Mississippi. So, Ellen, there's a lot on your plate here. It looks like you've got issues at least in three major watersheds here. EPA has TMDLs, pollution diets. They have a ton of them all over the country for specific pollutants. You've taken the step in the Chesapeake to have a TMDL. There are those who are afraid you're going to try to get one here in Florida, elsewhere. And there are the others who wish you would get around to doing it. Why aren't you doing it?
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you what we are doing in the Mississippi River Basin. But first, I want to answer the question you asked Nancy, because I happen to have a few facts and figures here about how widespread this problem is. And I know that reporters like facts and figures. So,
factoids.
You know, EPA works with the states to monitor the nation's waters, and then we have something called a National Aquatic Resource Surveys, which are statistical samplings all over the country. So we found that about 16,000 waterways are impaired by nitrogen and phosphorus. That means they have a standard that you're measuring against, and that they've exceeded that standard for nitrogen and phosphorus. 40% of the nation's river and stream miles have high levels of phosphorus. 27% have high levels of nitrogen. 5.7 million acres of lakes, reservoirs, and ponds are threatened or impaired by nutrients. And 78% of assessed coastal waters exhibit high nutrient concentrations. So that's a lot. So the problem is very widespread, although sources differ, you know, according to where we are. So let's turn to the Mississippi River Basin. Nancy talked about this hypoxia task force, which is a federal and state cooperative task force to address nutrient pollution in the Mississippi River Basin from the headwaters down to the Gulf, and a daunting task, a goal that has not been met, et cetera.
How many states are in this task force?
13, I think. Yeah, I think it's 13 states.
Does that encompass
states.
The entire Mississippi drainage, or is that just the core?
It's the main stem. Main stem states, and it's all the federal agencies. So one of the things that we've done in the hypoxia task force is we've challenged the states to each develop state nutrient reduction frameworks that look at the sources of, you know, what's going on in their state, talking about, you know, local, but how it affects downstream. So, you know, Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, all those states are developing frameworks. And as part of those frameworks, they have to address point sources and non-point sources. So we talked about how right now a lot of the sewage treatment plants, I think, Michelle, you mentioned this, a lot of the sewage treatment plants in the Mississippi River Basin do not have the kind of nitrogen and phosphorus load limits that the ones in the Chesapeake Bay do. Well, this is something that we told the states they need to address that in their plans. And there's various ways to address that. You don't just have to have a numeric nutrient standard to be able to put limits in your permits. For instance, in the Chesapeake Bay, that is not how we did it. I used to be the water director in Virginia, which is a big Chesapeake Bay state. And what we did was we used surrogates for nutrient pollution, like dissolved oxygen and submerged grasses, and back calculated the levels of nitrogen and phosphorus that you would need to reduce to reduce the dead zone, et cetera. And then we put those limits in sewage treatment plant permits. So that's another way you can do it. There's various ways to do it, but we're looking to the states under cooperative federalism to figure out those ways. We have also asked them to figure out what are they going to do about their non-point sources. And the issue of trading has come up because there's so many non-point sources, and there's sewage treatment plants that are going to need to upgrade. And I know the mayors of cities all up and down the Mississippi River are very interested in trading. We've talked to them, the Mississippi River's cities and towns, and I know they're going to be coming to our hypoxia task force next meeting, which is in Illinois in October.
So where is all this plan right now, and what's the deadline? Is there a deadline?
Well, by the end of this 2014, all the states will have their nutrient reduction plans, at least. They won't be implemented, but they'll have the plan. And by the way,
they'll turn in their homework.
Yes, the neat thing about this hypoxia task force is it's not just the water quality agencies that are represented. The states are also represented by their agriculture agencies, which is a key. We've got to get agriculture and water quality talking. And I think that's been a really great success of the hypoxia task force, even though we have such a daunting goal. But and then the key, of course, is going to be implementation. The other thing that we're working on are measures, because you can't just say, here's a plan, and, oh, by the way, whenever you get to it, that's great. So the task force is working on measures of success for both point sources and non-point sources. So a measure of success for point sources would be the percentage of sewage treatment plants that have permitted sewage treatment plants that have nitrogen and phosphorus limits, for instance.
Okay. I mean, we've dealt with this issue of measurements of success.
Yes.
And schedules and deadlines on the Chesapeake,
yep.
And we have kept moving the goalpost back. We're at 2025 now for when we will not have the bay cleaned up, but we'll have it all the things in place by then that should clean the bay up eventually. Is there any even that kind of a schedule for the Gulf
well,
yet?
What, so what we have the ultimate goal of the reduction of the hypoxic zone by however many miles, and you know, it's not good to keep moving the target. But what we found in the Bay that at least kept things feet to the fire was to have interim goals. And I think that's a really great way to, you know, you got to take baby steps. All of the states are under, you know, the economy is not great. You know, dollars going toward the environment get less and less, and we have to be, we've got to get some stuff done.
Okay.
But we need to take baby steps.
All right. Nancy, I've got a question. I think you wanted to respond to something here.
May I?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I mentioned earlier that changing the goals doesn't change the activities. That you need something to change the activities. I also, the state of Louisiana, instead of having a nutrient reduction strategy, they're calling theirs a nutrient management strategy. They got rid of the word reduction very, very quickly.
There Is that are a meaningful change in language.
It seems like it to me.
Words matter.
There are three coastal areas that are listed as impaired, and the state is trying to get them delisted. The governor of Louisiana is one of the 31 that is petitioning the EPA not to do the TMDL for Chesapeake. And if Louisiana had to pay or had to or was fined or pay, if they had to pay to put better nutrient concentrations into the river than what they receive, then there would be a lot of finger pointing upstream. And then Arkansas would point upstream. And then Tennessee would point upstream. So, and there are 31 states in the watershed. And most of it comes from the upper and the Ohio, just like the dots on Michelle's.
Okay. So, Michelle, question for you here. You said basically that without that kind of pressure from on the permitted dischargers of nutrients into these watersheds, there isn't going to be a whole lot of incentive for trading voluntarily here. We've got pressure on the Chesapeake Bay. How much trading is going on right now there?
You got me. So there are a variety of policy constraints from making that happen. So theoretically, it stands to serve that it should happen. But several of the state's trading policies actually restrict their point sources from trading with non-point sources. They don't state it directly, but they make it very, very difficult. So there are those concerns. For the states that don't have policy constraints, there is a lot of hesitation on the wastewater treatment facilities staff, as I mentioned. They worry. They don't know whether they have the legal wherewithal to send their ratepayer money outside of their jurisdiction up into the watershed, outside of their state, even potentially for an intrastate trading program. They're very worried that they're going to be buying credits from farmers in good faith, but nature gets in the way. It rains way too hard. It blows out the best management practice. So they've made an investment in good faith with this farming partner, or many, many farming partners, but nature ruins the solution. They're staffed by engineers who are very comfortable with the technologies that they can apply to their own facilities, and they're very reticent to send those funds elsewhere to these unknown technologies. So those are some of the reasons from an individual wastewater treatment facility standpoint, as well as a policy constraint standpoint, why it hasn't materialized.
Okay.
Can I talk about something we're doing to...
Real quickly, yeah, sure. Now, I got a question for Pat.
So, I agree with everything you've said, and I was an architect of Virginia's trading program, which it's working point to point source. So, point sources are trading with each other if they have excess capacity. It's a little harder with non-point sources because of the reasons you said. But what we're finding is for states or localities that have strict stormwater controls, that they're stormwater credit trading with land banks and involving farms and non-point sources. So that's another way. But USDA and EPA are working together on an online trading tool to sort of overcome some of the fears and barriers, and it's going to be for the sellers and the buyers in plain English to and a calculator so they can figure out if it's economical for them to do. And, you know, we're hoping that that will answer some of the questions you mentioned.
Okay, thanks. Pat, question for you here. There seems to be, I mean, there are some legal and policy debates around trading, are there not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, point to point, I agree with Ellen, has probably the best chance of success, and I think the Long Island trading program is probably one of the best models to look to. There's lots of safeguards built into the Long Island program. First of all, they've got their hands around all of the municipalities by – they're regulated, so they're all under a general permit structure that's transparent, that has great monitoring. That has enforceability, including citizen suit enforcement, and don't ever forget the critical role that citizens have played in advancing water quality success all across the country. So that's a good example. They have built-in safeguards for these so-called hotspot problems where you start trading pollution around and it ends up in the poorest neighborhoods, so to speak. You have to watch out for that. You have to have a declining cap. You know, it can't stay static. It has to keep lowering to drive the market. You got to watch out for not undermining the technology standards of the Act, not undermining the anti-backsliding provisions of the Act, not undermining the anti-degradation goals of the Act, all kinds of things you have to take into account. When you go from point to non-point, you've just, magnified the complexities, as Michelle has been pointing out, some of the issues there. I have come to the view, my background includes a stint as regional counsel with EPA enforcing the Clean Water Act, a stint as the environmental commissioner in Vermont implementing it at the state level, a stint in private practice representing people on the other end of these programs. I've come to the view after all these long years and torturous journey that probably almost everything we've tried is not working. So we better try trading, and we better try point to non-point, and we better structure it right, and we better be careful, and we better watch it like a hawk, and yada, yada, but we better try it. Because I'm telling you, the collaboration ain't working, the regulating non-point sources ain't going to happen, the money isn't going to flow out of the United States Treasury the way it did in the first days of the Clean Water Act. We're not going to buy our way to compliance with federal money. That's not going to happen. You can try cross-compliance. Most of these agricultural sources are getting boku federal dollars from all of us in the room, folks. They're getting all kinds of subsidies and price supports, even my precious farmers in Vermont. And in exchange for which they're doing what? They're shitting in our waters. And so at some point you have to say, stop it. You're getting all this federal money, all this federal support. It's time to pony up. It's time to step up to the plate and do what you need to do, what you know you need to do. Stop fighting everything and try to figure out what needs to be done. I don't say it's going to be easy or cheap or not without problems. I understand all that. But the point is we're losing this game. It's not just birds and bunnies. These are major fisheries going down, major sources of jobs, community well-being, culture. You know, a lot of the fabric and what's important here in our country is under tremendous stress. These natural systems are breaking down, and we've got to do something about it.
Thank you. I know everybody would like to still respond, and Michelle, you'll get a chance, but I think we need to open it up to Q&A from the audience now. So the way this is going to work is SCJ members and working journalists get to ask the questions first, and when they're exhausted, anybody else in the room can get up and ask a question. These are to be questions, not speeches. And, right, where the speeches are up here, and we'll try to keep them from filibustering so we can get as many questions in as possible. And please identify yourself and your affiliation when you are given the mic. Okay, let's start right here.
And I'm probably going to reserve a question for me.
All right.
I guess that's right.
Since you carry the mic, you can do it. Go ahead. All right, please stand and tell us your name.
Sit and
tell us your name then. All right.
Thanks. I'm Rachel. I'm a reporter with Bloomberg BNA's Daily Environment Report.
You have your last name, please.
Rachel Levin. Sorry about that.
Thanks.
And I actually have two questions. Number one is water quality trading, which is based on the cap and trade approach used in the emissions world, has not been applied nationwide. Rather, its application is limited to pilots, watersheds, et cetera. Can you Can you please explain why that is so? And the other question is...
One question.
Oh, sorry.
If we have time for a follow-up.
All right. Does anybody want to take a crack at that? All right. Quickly.
This is Ellen Galinsky from EPA, for the record. There are many pilots, but there's also actual trading programs. So in the Chesapeake Bay, those aren't pilots. Those are actual trading programs. The state legislatures have endorsed them, passed them. EPA has said they meet the Clean Water Act, and it's just a matter of them doing trades. The pilots that you refer to, you know, there's one in the Ohio River, that basin, which is really the first major interstate trading. And the reason that's a pilot is because there's not a driver in the Ohio. There's not limits in permits. There's not a TMDL, et cetera, et cetera. So there's also real trading going on for things other than nutrients, like temperature. In Oregon, there's a very successful temperature trading program that for temperature requirements that are in power plant permits because of the salmon. And there's been great successes in that. So I don't think it's true that there's just pilots. There are actual trading programs around the country working.
Thank you. My name is Cynthia Barnett. I'm an independent journalist and book author who writes on water, and I'm based in Florida. And I wanted to go back to maybe a bigger picture philosophical question and to make sure I understand the trading. When I look at the slides, it looks like urban ratepayers will be footing the bill for what is agricultural pollution. And I wondered if, in the big picture, has the country given up on the idea of polluter pays? You know, have we sort of lost that as a goal? Because that's what the economists would tell us would work in an ideal system. Thank you.
So for the first part of the question, Michelle Perez, the funding flow from a point source wastewater utility to farmers would only be to the tune of the permit that wastewater treatment plant would hopefully be given for nitrogen phosphorus pollution. So they are solving their portion of the problem by paying farmers who have a more effective, cost-effective way to reduce that specific amount of pollution. So yes, that's correct. And the reason why we must tolerate how some in the room might think that that is, you know, not the way to go, polluter pays principle, is because we have these laws that we are not able to improve and overcome that insists we can't regulate farmers, right? Because if farmers produce food, fiber, and fuel for our country, and we need to support them rather than restrict them. So if you agree or not to disagree with that, we're unable to overcome the political machine that keeps that in place. But regulations, I don't want anyone to think, are a silver bullet. They are not a silver bullet. I wrote a dissertation on Maryland, Virginia, and Delaware's nutrient management plan regulations, and happy to share those findings with you. It's very difficult to regulate farmers. You can't tell if they're complying, and you can't enforce compliance, right? It's a patchwork quilt of rural landscape out there. We don't have the boots on the ground to figure it out. So it's theoretically good to send regulatory signals at both the state and the federal level, but to actually gain behavior change, you have to win hearts and minds as well. And so nutrient trading kind of marries the best of both policy approaches, and I sympathize with the professor here that you know, you have to find the little nuggets out of these ineffective policies and try to amplify them. So nutrient trading can help if we have the regulatory driver. If we have no regulatory driver, wastewater treatment plants can still send money and funds to farmers and technical assistants through targeted watershed projects. They can still collaborate together, as is happening in many USDA programs now.
Hi, Bob Marshall. I'm with the Lens here in New Orleans. Is there a history of citizen suits or civil suits, someone filing a suit for damage done by this pollution that's being done, I guess, legally?
Oh, looking for damages, money damages? Pat Parento, looking for money damages, Bob, is that what you're asking? Oh, that's a real tough one. I mean, theoretically, you can bring nuisance cases, but they're expensive, they're hard to prove. You've got to get a lawyer who's willing to front the costs of it and hire the experts to do it. Causation is a big problem. Theoretically, the answer is yes. Realistically, we don't see very many cases like that where successful money damage cases have been brought dealing with nutrient pollution. I keep waiting for the day when there will be a major case like that breakthrough. What we're going to need is somebody like the tobacco lawyers with a lot of money in their kitty looking for contingent fee cases, finding enough damages in a watershed where there's an important fishery, for example, where it would really pay them to go in and kick some serious butt, shall we say. It probably will eventually happen with all the damage that's occurring. It hasn't happened yet.
Way back here, Jennifer. Thanks. Hi, I'm Jennifer Weeks. I'm a freelance journalist in Boston, and I'm writing something for Congressional Quarterly Press now that will include a look at hypoxia. I wonder, since this is also a big problem in Europe, whether any of you can talk about how it's been approached there and maybe approaches that have worked. I understand that there's been big improvements in the Black Sea as one example, and whether those approaches are things that could transfer to the U.S. or are come out of structures like the European Union that we don't have perfect equivalents for.
Nancy Rabelais, the European Union does have standards that cross all of the states, and there are definite limits on how much manure can be put on any piece of land and how much can be taken off. So there's very strong regulations. You refer to the Black Sea. It used to be the second largest hypoxic area, but not anymore because phosphorus and nitrogen were dramatically reduced, and it went from being two times larger than the one in the Gulf of Mexico to being almost non-existent. But that nitrogen and phosphorus reduction was due to the dissolution of the Soviet Union and no more subsidies for nitrogen and fertilizer. So it was an economic collapse that improved the water quality in the Black Sea. But it shows if the nutrients go up and it's low oxygen, and the nutrients go down, no more low oxygen.
Hi, Michael Hawthorne from the Chicago Tribune. Has anybody done an estimate on if in the Mississippi Basin you rein in the sewage treatment plants, what kind of effect that would have in the Gulf of Mexico? And then there was a bit of a confusion between Nancy and Ellen about the contribution of point sources in the Gulf of Mexico dead zone. I thought you said, Ellen, something I thought I heard, maybe I heard you wrong about point sources being a bigger percentage than I thought I heard her say.
I think the non-point based on the USGS data is about 10%. I'm sorry, the point is about 10%. What was the first of the question?
You've answered it then.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I'm going to jump in with a question.
Okay. Well, we have calculated how much needs to be reduced to reduce the size to the goal, which is 5,000 square kilometers. And when we did the first action plan, we estimated 30% reduction was required of nitrogen. The second action plan, based on the EPA Scientific Advisory Board report, was for 45% of both nitrogen and phosphorus to reach the goal.
And it did not specify source.
And the important thing with the nitrogen offshore is that we are now getting a larger dead zone per load of nitrate than we did in the past. So the system is having a hard time trying to respond to any nitrogen reduction.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here with my question. Karen Schaefer, freelance public radio journalist based in Oberlin, Ohio. Been covering, of course, the Lake Erie toxic algae. Actually, it's cyanobacteria, not toxic blue-green algae. For about 15 years, and we've been talking about it. But, of course, this year, 500,000 people lost their drinking water for 3 days. And fortunately, no one got sick. But we're talking in Lake Erie, yeah, hypoxia, that's nice. The fish have to move, other stuff doesn't. But we're talking about human health here. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about an urgent need to fix this problem. And in Lake Erie, 80% of the nutrient that's coming into the lake is coming off of farm fields. I don't see how pollution trading is going to work there. And all the scientists that are working on this issue agree that even if you reduced every single source by 40, maybe 50%, you're not going to get rid of the cyanobacteria. So, anybody, what's the solution here? And it has to work fast.
Well, thank you so much for asking that question. This is Ellen Galinsky, because I could not agree with you more about what you said and also that we need fast action. And this week on Wednesday, the administrator of EPA is the chair of the Great Lakes Interagency Task Force, which is all the members of the federal family who are involved in working on the Great Lakes. And she called a special meeting just about the you know, what to do about the Lake Erie situation and about harmful algal blooms. And each agency really rose to the occasion in terms of redirecting resources to the immediate problem. So I have to agree with you. In that case, trading is not the solution because they've got to reduce right now. So USDA directed a tremendous amount of money to a quick sign-up for cover crops in the basin, and it was sold out immediately. So this winter, all those farmers are going to be putting cover crops on, and then USDA is going to work to get that into a annual practice. But they wanted to immediately get that there. And similar to some of the work they did with Lake Champlain recently as well for the harmful algal blooms. So we've got to get reductions from everybody out there. We're looking at, the sewage treatment plants. A lot of them have advanced nutrient treatment, but, certain ones don't. There's a lot of NOAA is doing a lot with advanced monitoring and, like an early warning system, because what happened with the Lake Erie situation was, the perfect storm of, it was a circulation patterns and temperature and nitrogen and phosphorus. But really, you got to get the reductions now in a situation like that.
Okay.
One more question.
All right.
Here in the back.
Mr. Bruggers.
Hi, Jim Bruggers with the Courier Journal in Louisville, Kentucky. My state calls its nutrient reduction strategy a nutrient management strategy also, and it's about to come out. And if all these states are coming out with these strategies, presumably reporters are going to need to look at them and figure out whether or not they're effective or not. Do you have any advice or suggestions on what we should be looking for as reporters when these strategies are made available?
Numbers and timetables. Numbers and timetables. How much is going to be reduced by when, and how's it going to happen? We've had strategies for 40 years, 50 years maybe. We've had plans. What we don't have are numbers and timetables. And my point about narrative is, when you drive down the highway, if the sign said, please don't drive too fast, does that work? Or does 70 work? And I grant Ellen's point that you can create proxies for the metrics you want to use, but healthy grass is not an enforceable standard. Okay? Numbers and timetables.
Thank you, Pat.
I actually think that the professor's point is really good, but you need a 70-mile-per-hour sign limit to give the guidance for what everyone's trying to aim for. But if we don't solve the problem of figuring out how to get the farmers to adopt that incentivize them sufficiently, regulate them sufficiently, so that you don't lose their hearts and minds because you don't have the boots on the ground to figure out whether they are following those regulations. You've got just paper tigers, right? So my key message to reporters in the room is when you're writing about farmers and they're changing the behaviors, what I saw damage goodwill and good work from farmers in the Chesapeake Bay was sensational language from journalists that over... stated, you know, the phrase that gets farmers the worst, the most upset is pollution washing off their fields, right? It doesn't really wash off their fields. It percolates through groundwater. It moves very slowly. So I just ask that you think about carefully how you phrase it so that you gain greater potential for behavior change rather than make people dig in their heels. So my policy solutions to, once the numbers and timetables are in place, cracking the nut on how to get farmers to change their behavior. And I think we need new policies that get them to take risks to lower their nutrient applications, because applying cover crops is the Band-Aid solution afterwards. After you've reduced your fertilizer and manure application rates, but they're not going to do that unless they feel that their income isn't jeopardized because they fear that will lower their yield. So if we as taxpayers want to be a little smarter about our taxpayer support, we might think of new insurance policies that if farmers can show that they've been environmentally responsible, but they suffered economically for it, we can figure out appropriate ways to compensate them for that as society. I think thoughtful, nut-cracking solutions like that are the signals and the way we move forward on this.
Any last thoughts here, either of you? Okay. My one advice to you, Jim, is you know, also numbers behind these plans. Ask how much money they're going to put behind it and where it's coming from. These cover crop programs, cover crops work really well. It's soaking up nitrogen and phosphorus to a degree. But, you know, we're paying for them. The farmers aren't. It's $40 million for this year in Maryland alone. $40 million is coming out of, you know, the state's taxpayers' pockets and some out of the federal taxpayer pockets, too. Maryland has made a commitment to do that because they see it as very effective. But, you know, at some point you start add up all those dollars and ask, you know, are we getting the best bang for the buck? And does the public really know what we're paying for? You know, we're having that conversation in Maryland. We imposed a stormwater fee on many of our property owners this past year, and there was a little kerfuffle about that. The Republican governor promises to repeal the rain tax, as they like to call it. So look for that. Look for transparency in these plans so that you can actually follow them. In Maryland, all farmers are required to have a nutrient management plan, a thing to control that says how much fertilizer they're putting on the ground and how they're managing it, not necessarily reducing it, but they should be reducing it. Problem is, under Maryland law, those are private. They're confidential. The regulators are on top of it, of course. At least we hope so. So that's as far as we can go today. This is an endlessly fascinating topic to some of us. I thank you all for coming out. And what I would urge you, if you have further interest in this issue, you've got your choice of lunch topic today. This is a little plug for both of them. Nancy will be featured at the in-depth stories of our troubled seas, where they'll be talking much more globally, I guess, about these issues and more. And if you're interested in understanding more about the political quagmire that we have here over water in this country, you could join Ellen and me at another lunch table to talk about the waters of the U.S. rule. She's going to bring her secret maps and show them to you. All right?
I'll kill you.
All right. Thank you very much.